Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is Season 3, Episode 6 of Sublimely Gothic. I'm Amy, and today we are talking about The Quickening, a new gothic thriller by Rhiannon Ward. And guess what? Sarah Rhiannon Ward is here with me right now. Well, not physically, she's still in the UK, but virtually at least. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Amy. Thank you ever so much for inviting me.
Of course, it was such a delight that you decided to join us for my little dark gothic podcast. It's funny, I actually contacted you right after we finished discussing the book in my neighborhood book club.
Oh, lovely.
So yeah, so it was basically one of my other book club members. She gave a list of books and then she's like, okay, so kind of vote which one you want. And so we all agreed The Quickening was the one we wanted to read. And then I went to go like buy it. And I typically do secondhand books. So it's like, oh, it's like a new book at full price. I'm okay with that. But then I go there and I'm like, oh, why isn't it available? Like, why is the Kindle, but not the physical paperback or even hardcover? And then it finally dawned on me, oh, she's in the UK, isn't she?
Oh, that's lovely, though. I mean, I know book clubs, they're popular over here, but especially in the States. I mean, it's really great that somebody was reading it and recommended it. That's lovely to hear, really.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so the way that this podcast episode will work, you know, because we have a fellow writer being interviewed, the podcast format will be separated. So the first half of the interview will be pre-spoiler questions about Sarah Rhiannon Ward in general and vague allusions to the book and, you know, her writing style. But then afterwards, in the latter half, it will be post-spoiler, you know, discussion of The Quickening. So if you have, I will warn people when the pre-spoiler portion ends and when post-spoiler, you know, begins. But yeah, for warning everyone right now, if you have not finished The Quickening in its entirety, you know, you will only be able to enjoy part of this episode. So just, you have been duly warned. So let's see, what sort of questions did I have for you? Well, of course, the big one, that is, what specifically, you're okay with being referred to as Sarah, or did you prefer Rhiannon? I don't want to.
They call me Sarah, though. That's fine. Yeah, Rhiannon's my middle name, actually. So yeah, either's fine. But yeah, you can call me Sarah.
Okay, yeah, that's what I figured as well. But alrighty then. So question number one I had was, what specifically inspired this story for you?
Well, so I'd written 4 contemporary crime novels. So I'd started off my sort of writing career writing crime fiction. And my books always had a historical element. So my first book, In Bitter Chill, was partly set in the 1970s. And then for my fourth book, The Shrouded Path, I went back to the 1950s. So I was going back further and further in time. But the trouble is, when you're writing a sort of a dual narrative, in as much that part of it's set in the past and part of it's set in the present, you can't go that far back because you have to make the sort of crime relevant to the present day. And the further you go back, the harder it is to make it really, really relevant, or certainly that the style of the book I was writing. So I decided I'd really like to write a complete historical crime novel. So that was the sort of genesis, really. I want to go right back into the past. And I really like gothic fiction, obviously you do, Amy. And it's sort of having its moment at the moment, both in terms of contemporary gothic fiction and also those that which is set in either the gothic period, you know, the Victorian gothic period, or even afterwards. And I thought I'd love to give it a go. And so I love dual narratives, sort of split timelines. So I started off with an idea that something happened in the late Victorian period, so 1896, which is sort of high Victorian, high Gothic period. And part of the book is set then. But the vast majority of the narrative is set in 1925, which isn't a decade we necessarily associate with the Gothic, but it's got that sort of real feeling, and I think it works really well in books generally, are periods of change. And the 1920s, a bit like I think that the 2020s are going to be, is there's a sort of shifting dynamic. So there was the feeling that that lots of people had experiences of losing people in the First World War, which had finished in 1918. And then following the end of the First World War, there'd been the Spanish flu pandemic, and people had lost loved ones in that as well. So there was this sort of collective hangover from two really, really traumatic events. But at the same time, society was changing. And so women, certainly in the UK, women had the vote. Women over the age of 30 were given the vote. And so women were able to go out and, you know, sort of contribute more to society. So, you know, you didn't need to make a story around that period just in the domestic sphere. You could have a woman like my main protagonist, Louisa Drew, go having a profession and actually going out and about and undertaking work. And so I was really attracted to sort of that split timeline. And that was the genesis, really. And the other thing I wanted to do, my contemporary crime novels were set in the Peak District. I live in the Derbyshire Peak District, which was the sort of, I suppose the nearest city to me is Manchester, but that's a good like hour and a quarter away from me. And I live, it's very rural. And my book was sort of in the countryside, my previous novels, whereas this is all more or less all set around a house called Clewer Hall. And I wanted to write a story where everything happens in the house. So it's very, very contained. Anything that's happening is either to do with the house or to do with the occupants who were staying in the house at that particular period. And so it was closing the sort of scope of the narrative right down to its essential, which is the home and its occupants.
Wonderful. Yeah, like part, as you said, like the era of change that was going on in the 20s, particularly because, again, things had changed so much because of the First World War and then, as you said, the Spanish influenza.
Yeah.
So, like, even within the niche of Gothic literature, this book falls within, like, my favorite niche within Gothic literature, which is sort of the haunted house novel between the Edwardian period and the 50s.
Yeah, great.
Because I'm all about the house being the metaphor for the declining aristocracy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, as an American, it's not as if, again, there aren't, you know, there isn't inequalities and inequity, you know, but as an American, there is this sort of, you know, fascination, the fact that that sort of inequality had a title to it in the UK with the peerage system.
Yeah, yeah. It actually makes for sad reading. Now, I do come, you know, I don't come from an elevated background, so my ancestors would have been the servants, not the aristocracy. But reading about, the decline of the country house in the post-war period, post-First World War period, is really, really interesting, and it's quite tragic because a lot of these families, they lost like three, they could lose three heirs. It's not, which is what happens in my book. And it's not, you know, completely unbelievable. It's what happened. So, you know, you would have a landed gentry and their first son would be killed, then their second son, and they would be left with no heirs. And they would put their houses up for sale. Plus, of course, they couldn't get servants anymore because the housemaids and the butlers and during the war the men had been fighting and the women had worked in factories and so on, and they preferred it. If you'd been a housemaid, it was, you know, a terrible hours. You'd get up really early, go to bed late, physically exhausting, and they changed jobs to fill the factories while the men were fighting, and they preferred it. They liked the camaraderie of working in, on the conveyor belt or whatever they were doing. And people didn't want to go back and become a housemaid again. So they've lost all their servants as well. It's a real period of change, and it is tragic. And I appreciate, you know, especially if you're in the US, you know, the class system can be quite sort of, it's as if you're looking down a lens at it. And of course, it's equally tragic. I mean, I live in a little village and we've got a big war memorial. So families, we've got about an occupants of about 300, and that's been steady for about hundreds of years. And, you know, they lost, you know, 10, 15, 20, 20 people in the house. So in the village. So, you know, it was a tragedy across society. But there is something poignant, I think, and I'm sure you agree, if you like Gothic, about a sort of house that was once grand and it's gone into sort of disrepair through, you know, for various reasons.
Indeed. That's why, again, some of my favorites of, again, this sort of period is, what is it? What was it? Oh, The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters.
Yeah.
That talks about the real end, like by the late 40s, that it's just completely collapsed.
Yeah, exactly.
But wonderful. So yeah, let me get in my next question. So I think you brushed upon it a little bit, but so what, I think, well, yeah, you already answered this question. It was, what made you want to shift gears to a more Gothic after your time with your crime fiction series? And I think you brought into, it really came from the desire to do something much significantly more historical.
Yeah. I mean, where I live in Derbyshire, we have a strong Gothic tradition anyway, in terms of literature. So, one of the early Victorian Gothic novels, Sheridan Le Fanu's Uncle Silas, is...
I love Uncle Silas!
Yeah. Well, that's set in Derbyshire. Once she... I can't remember the heroine's name, but once she goes north to a horrible uncle's house, that's Derbyshire. So, the big grey houses that are sort of dark and so on. When Sheridan Le Fanu was looking for, you know, somewhere to dark to set it, he decided on Derbyshire. So that's an early, Victorian Gothic novel that I love. Another one is Bram Stoker's The Lair of the White Worm. Again, that's set on the Derbyshire borders, because we have a big limestone sort of landscape here. So we have lots of caves. And when he wanted this sort of landscape where this big worm can hide, he chose the Derbyshire Cheshire border. So again, that was an influence. And Arthur Conan Doyle, he, as well as his Sherlock Holmes stories, he obviously wrote other stories without Sherlock Holmes. And he set quite a few in the Peak District in Derbyshire, where I live, because when he was a medical student, I think he just qualified, he worked in Sheffield, which is a nearby city, and he used to come out here. So one of his stories is the Terror of the Blue John Gap, which is about a cave where something terrible happens in there. So we have this sort of, I live in quite a gothic environment anyway.
Yeah, yes, definitely. And I actually, it is a lesser known work of his, but I actually have read The Lair of the White Worm.
Oh, brilliant. Did you know?
Yeah, because I bought a whole like complete works ebook collection of Bram Stoker for like 99 cents.
Okay.
Like I see where you're coming from with, you know, pure the physicality of the environment, how that could be an influence. Honestly, I hated Lair of the White Worm for how racist it was.
In terms of what? In terms of him being Australian, or in terms?
No, like it, like the way the people speak of both the protagonist and others about the black servant, and he's evil, and just it was to a level. Like, of course, a lot of those classical Gothic novels require a certain degree of historical forgiveness, but that was okay. No amount of centuries can justify that. Was horrible.
Well, that's interesting, because it's been a while since I've read it, so it would be probably worth me rereading it and seeing how you know, because things have changed even in the last 5-10 years and so on. So and it's certainly been a while since I've read it, so that'd be really interesting to reread it, actually. And you know, it's quite interesting for you to have that feedback, because you know, when I'm talking about works of literature, a lot of my influences I read as a teenager, and that was quite a few years ago, and it's quite interesting to have, you know, a sort of more contemporary view on these novels. So I will go back and reread it. Thank you for that.
Yeah, but anyway, we digress. So I guess, kind of going into, you know, your two genres, crime fiction novels and then your gothic thriller, The Quickening, you know, there is a bit of overlap. And I'm just curious, like, what were the reasons for the subtle, like, name change? Because as I understand it, your crime novels were written under, you know, your first and last name, Sarah Roard, but The Quickening was you decided to use your middle name. So what was the reasoning behind that?
Well, when my editor and I talked about it, neither of us had a particularly strong view either way, to be honest. I think we wanted to, so we did have a discussion about putting it out under Sarah Roard, but I think we wanted to make it a bit different to my Derbyshire books. So we decided just to use my middle name. So it still feels like me, because obviously it's a name I use and so on. It is quite useful, actually, because my next book, after the Quickening, I've got a book coming out in September called The Shadowing, and I can say it's a Rhiannon Roard book, and immediately I don't have to explain it as much, because people know it's going to be a gothic thriller. It's set in a completely different period, actually, but it's quite nice to brand your historical fiction slightly different to your contemporary crime. And if I wrote another contemporary crime novel, I might use, you know, go back to Sarah Roard, you know, and so on, what we'd see. So, yeah, there wasn't any sort of great discussion about it. It's just we had a sort of brief chat about what name to put it out on, and we decided to just use my middle name.
Yeah, because I just first found that quite interesting, because there is quite a lot of overlap between those two genres. Mm. You weren't going from, like, epic fantasy all the way to, you know, gothic fiction set in the 20th century. But yeah, no, that's interesting, because I'm currently in the midst of trying to write my first gothic novel, you know, which will be under my name, but there are a whole bunch of other ideas of other genres, and I'm just wondering, will I ever have to think about that?
Yeah, you might do. I mean, these things do tend to be publishing driven. You know, it can be author driven. People might say, I want to write something different under a new name, but often publishers have a view. So it was certainly a discussion to have with my editor when I'd written it and so on. But I'm quite relaxed about it, to be honest. So many people have different identities when they're writing now. It's become more and more popular, really. I mean, it goes back years, doesn't it? I mean, I'm a big Ruth Rendell fan, and Ruth Rendell wrote Barbara Vine books as well. So, there's quite a long history of writers writing under different names.
Of course. So let's see, what's another question I had? Ooh. So how did you go about the historical research for your novel? Because, again, this was kind of your biggest leap into history thus far.
Yeah, I think I was stressed about it quite a lot, to be honest, because it was my first historical novel. I had written my fourth book set in the 1950s, so I obviously had to do research for that, because I wasn't around in the 1950s. But I think because I was writing late Victorian and the 1920s, I was so keen to get it right, and so I did an awful lot of research on reading around the period. But I also went to the British Library, and I did I looked at contemporary narratives, brochures. So, for example, my main protagonist, my Louisa Drew, is a photographer, and I went to the British Library and I got manuals for the type of camera she would be using, and I just read them. And you can take photographs. It's not like the days when I was doing my master's, where you weren't allowed to photocopy. You could only photocopy anything, and you used to rack up huge fees. Now you can just get your phone out and photograph the page in the British Library. So I was photographing really old pamphlets. I would get a pamphlet on how to develop. So there's a scene in The Quickening where Louisa is in the ice house of the main house. It's in the gardens, and she's developing something. And I wanted just to walk through the process of how she would get her little travelling kit out and her plates, and then, you know, develop them. And I was just able to do that by just looking at a contemporary manual on how to do it. So I did an awful lot of research, including looking at original documents. And I spent a lot of time doing it. So I hope it's accurate. It's as accurate as I could get it, because I really did spend a long time on it. And what's funny is my next book, The Shadowing, was written completely in lockdown. And so I didn't have access to,
those resources.
No, I didn't. But, you know, there's quite a lot online. And I was a bit more relaxed about it because it was my second historical novel. And I realised that all the research I did for The Quickening, I had to not use 90% of it because it was just, in effect, just background reading. And that hasn't gone away, really. So, I'd done quite a lot of reading about the Victorian period that would stand me in good stead for quite a few novels, really.
Right, wonderful. So that kind of segues well into the next question. So this novel takes place, as you said, in the 1920s, but a lot of flashbacks to the, you know, late Victorian period.
Yeah.
So what was the desire specifically to explore the Victorian age of seances and that sort of beginnings of New Age spiritualism and its potential, you know, ramifications, you know, later on in decades later?
Yeah, so it's something I'm quite interested in, as much my husband's a spiritualist, so he attends spiritualist services, not seances, but services where a medium comes in to a room of people and gives readings. And it's not my belief system at all. So I'm a churchgoer, so but at the same time, I was interested in it. So I would pop along occasionally to the services he goes to. And when I first went, I was really scared. I said, I hope I don't get a message, you know. It's like anything, isn't it? Once you've done it a few times, it's not scary at all. And it was quite interesting. And, you know, and I don't mean to offend anybody who's listening who believes in it, but there are people, I think, who genuinely give information that I don't know how they could know. But then I saw quite a few people who were just, you know, trying to extract information from people who were often in the services. It's attended by people who are grieving because you've just lost somebody and you want to try and get in touch with them. And I totally understand the motivations behind that. But it makes people extremely vulnerable for charlatans, basically. So that's what I wanted to explore, really. And Ada Watkins, my medium in The Quickening, and this isn't the spoiler, I know we're in the spoiler-free bit at the moment, she uses some of the tricks of the trade, but is she completely fake? Because, you know, and that's what I want to leave the reader with, really, in that for women at that time, especially if you were working class, there weren't many roles available that put you in the public sphere. I mean, one that immediately springs to mind are music halls. So women could go on the stage and write and sing bawdy songs about, you know, men, which often have quite an interesting social message. And mediumship was another way of doing that, because when you read the transcripts of mediums and how they've, you know, what they've, the readings they've given, often they're quite subversive and they're being quite rude about men. And I quite liked that, really. So I gave Ada Watkins, she's a bit sort of, you know, this is sort of, what's the word I'm trying to think of? But she's a mixture of genuine and also a bit of a trickster, really. And that's what I wanted to explore, really, about the whole spiritualist aspect. And of course, by 1925, you had the First World War, and spiritualism, to a certain extent, was in decline. And certainly Arthur Conan Doyle was, his reputation, he was a big believer in spiritualism, his reputation took a big hit because he continued to promote it. He fell out with Harry Houdini over it and so on. So it's a really, really interesting topic that you could just write about it time and time again. And I just find it really interesting.
Wonderful. We'll explore this more in the post-spoiler section.
Yeah.
But for now, well, I think, let's see. Oh, so what do you want people to take away from their reading of The Quickening?
What do I want them to take away? That's a really, really interesting question, because in my experience, readers take away whatever, you know, sort of preoccupations, prejudices, what they like and so on. That
implicit biases.
Yeah, that the author has no idea when they're writing. So what I was writing for myself was an exploration of a woman who has had lots of awful things happen to her. She's had her first husband has died in the trenches. She's lost two children in the Spanish flu epidemic. And she's starting again. She's met somebody who just provides security for her. And she's having his child and she's married to him. And her sort of career has just gone into decline because, you know, as there are today, there's a tension between having children and having a successful career. And then she gets this opportunity.
Oh, of course.
Yes. And then she gets this opportunity to photograph a house. And she's like, I'm going. Even though she's quite heavily pregnant and, you know, and she thinks there's something wrong with the house and her husband clearly doesn't want her to go, she goes. And I wanted to sort of explore, that's what I wanted people to take away with, really, in terms of, you know, the sort of how things haven't changed that much in terms of, you know, trying to do work and so on. And then there's the sort of, there's this sort of supernatural element, because it's not an accident she's pregnant, because what I wanted was a woman who is experiencing supernatural events and isn't really believed. And one way of doing that, you know, there's various ways of having women not believed, and it's been explored time and time again in literature, but one way of doing it is that she's pregnant. I spoke to quite a few friends who've had children. And, you know, the bigger you get, the more sort of patronized you are. And I thought, if, you know, these various happenings that occur, people will just put it down to her pregnancy. And so that adds that sort of extra element. Is you've not only got the medium, do you believe or not, but is Louisa actually seeing what she's saying? Because it was the first book I wrote from the first person point of view. All my previous books had been the third person, and I wanted it to be first person because you're completely in Louisa's head. So you know, you have to believe what, or not believe what she's seeing. You don't get an external view of what's happening to her.
Right, wonderful. Again, we'll explore that more soon, but I think my last question in pre-spoiler section is, again, what are your top three favorite Gothic novels thus far, be they classical or modern or anything?
Well, so I love Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. I think that's a Gothic novel. I think it's got lots and lots of Gothic elements, so I love that. I think it's modern Gothic, and it goes to show how Gothic doesn't need to be dark and grey. It's the sort of wider tropes that are interesting, and that's Jane Harper's The Lost Man. So it's set in the Australian outback, and a man's found dead in the shadow of a grave. So there's this gravestone in the middle of the desert, and it was the only place he could find shade, and he's found dead, and it's just so Gothic. So I love that. And then I suppose my third book, I would have to go to something like Uncle Silas or something like that, because I love the Victorian Gothic as well.
Yeah, for me, there's no way I could, like, I always, you know, divide them between classical and modern because I just love them all so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for modern, my top three I would have to say would be Shadow of the Wind.
Oh, yes, yeah, lovely.
Yeah, I was so, so mad when I found out he passed away.
Yes, yes, I know. I've still got I've got his next one, isn't it? The Labyrinth like that to read.
That's the huge one. I still need to finish that one, but I've read all the others. I even read all of his other, like, non-Cemetery of Forgotten books, novels.
Oh, yes, I've read that. Yes, I've read those. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, Shadow of the Wind, favorite, second favorite, The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova.
Oh, no, I like that. Yes, that's good. That is excellent. I remember reading. I read those two, actually, Shadow of the Wind and The Historian, similar time. So I, you know, when you read a book and you can put yourself in that particular time. I remember I was living and working in London, and I remember reading The Historian on a train going in back and forth to London.
Yeah, no, I read them like back to back as well, because one of my book club members chose The Historian, and to go off on the same theme of like books,
yeah,
within the story of a book within a book, you know, I chose Shadow of the Wind.
Of course, yeah, brilliant.
And then the third one, I think it'll, The Ghost Rider by John Harwood.
Oh, yes. Yes, I've got that on my shelf somewhere, actually. Yes.
Yeah, I finally, like, yeah, that one, just the whole idea of the Austria, like, something freaked out the mother so bad she moved halfway across the world to Australia, and they, you don't know what happens and you have to backtrack. And then all the, like, novellas within the story, I thought that was great.
I might get that out and reread it, actually, now you've mentioned it. I read it when it came out, and I haven't read it since, so that sounds
like... Oh, it was, that was 15, 20 years ago when it first came out. Yeah, like, I just read it, like, a year ago, because I was on my, you know, haunted house, like, stint. And so, yeah, I checked it out. Or I checked out the audiobook on one of the, like, library resources. And then finally, I'm like, this is definitely one of my favorites. And I bought my own that's on my shelf now.
Right. Oh, that's great.
All righty, everyone. And now we are moving on to the spoiler section. So if you have not read The Quickening and do not want to be spoiled, you should stop listening right now. So I've just got a variety of notes and comments here that can prompt discussion. So we, as you breached upon a little bit, I really love the fact that your protagonist is a working woman, because of course it highlights, you know, the realities of how society was changing, and a lot of ways that a lot of the way society changed wasn't because the society necessarily wanted it. They literally had no other choice when the war came. Like, just otherwise they just would have had society just come to a screeching halt, and they could not, you know, logistically afford that during a war. And then the war is over and they want everything to be back to normal, but it's like, no, we don't want to go back to how things were.
Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, because I suppose the narrative that we have about the time is often a sort of middle class narrative in terms of, you know, the Victorian woman was confined to the home, and then, you know, gradually they had more and more freedoms. And so by the 1920s, you know, they were able to work and so on. But I do a lot of my own family history, and the women in my family were working all through the Victorian period because they were working class. They were, I mean, my 3x great grandmother was a knitter of stockings. That's what she did. So when I'm sort of writing, I try and put some subtleties in terms of, so Louisa Drew comes from an ordinary background. She's not working class, but she picks up a camera and she starts taking photographs and is good at it. I didn't base her on a real life person, but the actual sort of act of picking up a camera and making a profession of it is based on the photographer Christina Broom. And she took photographs of ordinary people around London about the same period. And so I wanted her to be like Christina Broom, in that she's a professional. So she works for a magazine, she works for a magazine in the sort of Edwardian times, and then she works for a sort of a person who sends an agency. So that was really, really important to show how she's emancipated. But at the same time, it's the 1920s, so she's still, you know, if she wants security, she has to get married. We often judge periods by the outliers, so the people who buck convention, and we forget about the vast majority of people who convention, you know, that they were bound by convention, really. And so Louisa remarries to a man who's not up to much, basically, just for the security. She wants more children, and for the security she marries Edwin, and so it's that sort of tension. And it can be quite hard, I think, for a modern readership to understand how much things have changed even in the last 20 years. And so when I'm writing historical fiction, especially in the early 20th century, I want to show how there's that sort of tension between the two. Women are getting more freedom, but there's still a huge obligation to follow convention. And the other thing is I found with Louisa Drew, it was quite hard to research the minutiae of her day-to-day life, because there's not much written about the ordinary person. So if you type in 1920s bedwear, for example, what you've got is like loads of negligees and so on, which people like my grandmother or, you know, the ordinary woman didn't wear to bed. And they wore sort of homemade flannelette nighties. I don't know what you call them in the States, but, you know, the sort of nightwear. And to find out that, I had to look at patterns, sewing patterns, and see how sort of working women would have made their own nightwear or the go into department stores. And it can be quite hard to research. And yet it's those sort of people I'm interested in, really, not the negligee wearing protagonist.
Yeah. And again, and by making your protagonist heavily pregnant at the time, it ties into the whole theme of, you know, children dying at the house, which puts her in an extra vulnerable position. So thematically, but even just, you know, societally, it makes all the stigmas of women working all the more worse, to the point that her husband comes to like try and get her to come home.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole sort of children dying thing, I mean, it's very popular in thrillers, gothic thrillers in crime. In crime fiction generally. And it's this whole sort of, you know, the sort of gothic where things get a bit grotesque, really. Now it doesn't with Louise's children's deaths. I don't think that's grotesque. But the baby inside her, is that there's this idea, is it responding to an external presence in the house, which borders on the grotesque. And then the there's a sort of boy who might be haunting the garden, which again is grotesque. But what's really interesting, I'm interviewing somebody called Peter Ross, who's written a book called A Tomb with a View. And
nice.
yeah, it's really, really good. And it's a sort of history of graveyards in the UK. And he talks about how people are always fascinated with children's graves. And I totally understand that. I used to walk to school every day. I went to a Church of England school, and I used to walk through a graveyard every morning to get to school. And there were children's graves at the end of the path. And we always used to stop and look at them. As children, we were fascinated by other children who had died, you know. And it goes right up to adulthood, really. And so I think gothic fiction allows you to sort of not play with it, but, you know, explore it a little bit and sort of make it quite creepy, really, because it touches quite a lot of people's own experience, really.
And so going back to, you know, Louisa as a working woman, and again, like, I, you know, appreciate in a novel that she's dealing with all these stigma, but she is still a working woman and is a working woman in a realistic sense for the time period. And so I was just finalizing my notes like a few hours ago, and I came across this, the most recent review of your book. It's a 5 stars, but do I have your permission to read an excerpt of it so we can talk about it?
Yeah.
So this just really was very jarring to me. So the reviewer refers to himself as SD.
Okay.
And again, 5 stars, all night read. He really liked it. But the way he starts it out is, I rarely buy books by female authors or about female characters, with one of two exceptions. But I read the jacket note and liked the idea of this book, as for once it had a female protagonist who didn't faint, scream, or rely on long descriptions of size and sex to fill the pages. And I'm just like, I beg your pardon.
I don't read my reviews, to be honest. So
okay.
I keep an eye on Amazon in terms of how many I've had, because it's just quite useful to know. But I tend not to read them because, you know, 90% of the time, it's not going to help me writing my next book, to be honest.
So I wanted to share this with you again, not to really, again, he really loved the book.
It's really interesting when you read it out, actually. I've done various book selling things over the years. And so that idea that I don't read books by women is still really, really common. And you probably know, Amy, in terms of the readership of gothic thrillers, it's probably the same as readership of crime fiction. About 70% of my readers are women, I would say. But that means 30% the rest of are men who are happy to pick up. I don't buy the women screaming and stuff. I mean, there are some books like that, but it's...
I guess I'm just... You know, I'm glad you quote-unquote converted him in a way, but at the same time, like, the way he, like, describes this with such contempt that, yeah, there are, like, again, attaching all of this maybe genre or niche of like books or literature that he doesn't like and attributing it completely to female authors. And I'm just like, excuse me?
Well,
it was just very interesting to have that comment for, again, for all of the notions of society and gendered expectations that we have, and how all of those are talked about in this book, that someone would, for what all the book discusses and the socioeconomic commentary, that they would even write that.
I know. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I wrote The Quickening, we talked about it in the gothic sense, but when I wrote it, I think I was as much influenced by the English ghost story tradition as the gothic tradition. So if you think of someone like M.R. James and so on, so I feel that I've written a ghost story that's not sort of scary, but, you know, it has the sort of origins of the English ghost story tradition, really. And in terms of the traditional gothic, the gothic tradition, I do have some issues with it because it's always women in peril, isn't it? And women are rarely the architects of their own redemption in traditional Victorian gothic.
Anne Radcliffe?
Yes, but, you know, often it's the man who's the predator or the saviour, really. And so I really wanted to make sure that Louisa was the architect of her own sort of escape, really. So, but nevertheless, you know, even when it's women in peril, I do think that, this view of hysterical women screaming doesn't stack up with any novel you've read in the last 100 years, really.
Yeah, and I'm definitely one of those people that even with old school gothic like Anne Radcliffe, right, I always like to push back against this sort of oversimplified damsel in distress,
yeah,
archetype, because, you know, a lot of her heroines, you know, for us, they may seem passive, but they're like running away. They're like escaping. They are taking agency in their destinies in the limited manner that they can. And to just write them off as, oh, they have to be saved by a man.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like that. And I don't like how this dude, as much as he praises your book, I do not like how he was alluding to that.
That's fair enough. And the thing is with gothic fiction, it's been always, you know, it's often been written by women for women, and so, you know, I it's a bit like romance novels. I hate it when people are a bit sniffy about it, because it's almost, you know, women can't read what they enjoy, really. I did a book club event recently with my cousin's book club, and they were great, actually, and I really, really enjoyed it. But they sort of said, well, you know, all these things happen in The Quickening, you know, it's not particularly realistic. And I thought, no one reads gothic fiction for realism, do they? I mean, you know, you try and put as much, you know, you try and make everything fit. You know, the thing with crime fiction is everything has to be explained towards the end, and with gothic fiction you don't have to do that quite as much. But I did try and tie up all the ends and so on. I spent a long time on the plot. I think most genre writers, and in particular crime writers, we spend an awful lot of time on the plotting to make sure it all sort of comes together, really.
I just wanted to mention that, because again, wasn't even gonna like bring it up, but then I just saw it and I'm just like, I beg your pardon. But what other notes did I have? So I think the reason I was looking at these reviews, because what I really enjoyed about it in the book is, again, the notion of classism and that commentary. And so the review I gave to The Quickening, if I'll read it now, is, beyond just being an excellent addition to the Gothic collection of potentially haunted houses, I really like the exploration of Victorian age seances, plus the extensive socioeconomic commentary on the classism within that movement and in society in general. To give an example, I really love the conversation between Louisa and, was it Quinlivan or one of the servants, where he's talking about the sort of apparitions that soldiers have claimed to have seen in the battlefield, you know, in World War I, but people dismiss that because a lot of these soldiers are not from the upper class, but only when someone like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle says something spiritual happened, it's taken seriously. So just talking about, you know, it's that movement, you know, wasn't just about viewing, you know, trying to break out of, you know, the traditional notions of how we perceive the dead or can we communicate with them or not, but it is very much structured on this sort of classes system that only testaments of this sort of paranormal activity can be believed by someone of the upper class.
I mean, the mediums were usually working class, and so they were sort of hustled in through the side servant entrance and put on the sat at the table with all the of the people of the house, and then sort of sent away again at the end of it. So there's sort of a class thing in terms of who's doing the revealing and who's being revealed to. I found that really, really interesting when I was researching the history of, people often have otherworldly experiences or visions in times of extreme crisis. And what can be, you know, a worse crisis than, you know, fighting a battle in the trenches. And so soldiers did have various sort of experiences. But at the same time, the most famous, the Angel of Mons, I mention it in the book, is where in the sky, an angel appeared in the sky. And that was actually a story. And it became sort of known as, not fact, but it entered mythology then. So it was, and that helped sort of, it allowed people to criticize the people who were talking about battlefield experiences because they could say, well, it started off as fiction. But that's not to say other people didn't have it. And I went to the Institute of Psychical Research in London, and I was reading some of the pamphlets, and people, you know, would see their dead comrades marching next to them. And I just find it fascinating, really. And what's really, really interesting is that, and it's a bit like the pandemic now, is that when the men returned from the war, they thought, oh, you know, we'll be able to talk about everything that's been through. And people didn't want to know. The average person, like, say, for example, in my village, they didn't want to talk about it. They just wanted to move on. And I remember when I was researching the book, I thought, God, that is really, really strange. I mean, fancy, you know, someone's been fighting in France for their country, and they come back and people don't want to talk about it. But having lived through, you know, COVID-19 and so on, I don't think once this year's out I ever want to talk about COVID ever again. So it's kind of made me reassess how we deal with, you know, wide-scale trauma and how we fix our sights firmly in front of us when something's over, really.
Yeah, so yeah, I really enjoyed, you know, that element of classism, not just talking about the general decline of, you know, the aristocracy, but also the specific classism within that spiritual movement.
Right.
And I'm just curious, did you ever read The Silent Companions by Laura Purcell?
I have read it, yes.
So I just noticed that there are a lot of comparisons between, first off, this is common in Gothic fiction, you know, others as well, but you definitely, the format of, you know, going back between the 20s and and Victorian period, that kind of reminded me of Silent Companions in that, you know, it starts in the Victorian period and then there's the backstory, the flashbacks of the, you know, from like the 17th century.
Oh, great.
And then also, yeah, the protagonist is a pregnant woman who goes to the country house to like do whatever she has to do.
Do you know what? I hadn't thought about it. I have read The Silent Companions, but funnily enough, I didn't think about it at all when I was watching The Quickening. But my next book, The Shadowing, there's part of it is set in a church, and it's based on a church in Devon, where some of my family are originally from, and the vicar used to preach to cardboard cutouts of this congregation. And I wanted to put something very similar in my book, but I've made it like Straw Men, because that's kind of got a sort of view of it, and it's much earlier, it's in the 1830s, so it's much, much earlier than the sort of cardboard of the, I think it was the 1940s or whatever. And I remember thinking The Silent Companions, it mustn't be anything like that, because there's a sort of there's a figure as well. So yeah, I did think about it when I was writing my next book, to think, you know, I must make sure that it's not like The Silent Companions. I never even thought about it during The Quickening. So it goes to show that people like yourself, I'd forgotten there was a pregnant protagonist. Now you tell me, yes, there was. I remember.
Yeah, she loses
that's
the baby,
right,
and
does, doesn't she?
And yeah. And the it's not so much about the. Well, there is the one child. Yeah, gothic fiction wrought with evil devil children.
Yeah.
Evil devil ghostly little children.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, again, I loved the character of Ada Witkins because, as you kind of said in the pre-spoiler part, I really like the fact that there were combinations of the fact that you can see Ada Witkins is a entrepreneurial person where she is using the tricks of the trade, if we will, and she is engaging in some of those like psychological activities of digging into people to try and fish out like what are their
yeah.
like not, I wouldn't say weaknesses, but just, you know, what their quote unquote secrets are.
Mm.
You know, so she is doing that, but of course you do also write this section where Ada herself sees the little boy.
Yeah.
So, and then, so that begs the question of, you know, I like the fact that it was both. And, mm-hmm. And then the use of the tarot cards in the book, because I myself am pagan.
Oh, right.
So,
okay, great.
Yeah. So I'm not a spiritualist in the sense like your husband, where I go to mediums or anything, but I do have a big black obsidian crystal ball
right.
that I light incense and candles and do tarot readings. So I liked the way that you didn't overdo the notion of tarot cards in being like direct foreshadowing or anything, that they were just there more as a sense of slight illusion, but also more as like a sense of, you know, Louisa takes them as a sort of kinship between herself and Ada.
Yeah, I mean, with gothic fiction, you've got to be careful you don't just throw everything into the book. And I did wonder whether or not to take the tarot out, because they don't really contribute a lot to the narrative, except, as you say, it's part of Ada's bag of tricks, really. It's part of her various things she does. And with the tarot, again, it's, you know, that there is that sense of mystery in terms of the things she's suggesting. So I did research the tarot, and, you know, the things that the particular cards she chooses does foreshadow to a certain extent. But actually what I based those scenes on is that I've got quite a lot of links to Iceland, and that's where I met my husband and got married out there. And they, I've got friends who do runes. They read runes.
Oh, I do runes too.
Do you? And so I chose it. I sort of set it up in the way that I was with the runes, because they gave me a bag and say, it's, you know, put your hand in and what feels hot to you. And I thought, oh, none of them feel hot. Oh no, what am I going to do? And sort of Louisa panics a bit, you know, because Ada says, choose a card, whichever sort of is speaking to you. And Louise is like, I don't know, they all look the same. And she sort of panics and points at one of them. And I was a bit like the rune, you know, I was like, oh, I'll just take one. But funnily enough, when the rune was read, it was actually very, very sort of, you know, almost sort of very aligned to what something had happened to me quite recently at that time. So it stayed with me. Yeah, completely. So you do the runes as well, do you?
Yes, I'm very new. I'm still trying to like memorize all of their meanings and such. Like, in fact, in my Harry Potter podcast, we draw a tarot card to discuss those meanings as they pertain to the chapters, and then we also pick a rune to discuss those themes within the chapters.
Okay, interesting.
Interesting. What I thought about, like, once everything started to be revealed, Helen, the matriarch. So Helen ends up being the person who has killed Ada.
Yeah.
And so my note here is like the tragic mother is both the feminist and the anti-feminist figure.
Mm.
And what I wrote about that, I just, for whatever reason, in this book, it just really got me thinking again and again, because motherhood and just expectations of women is a core tenet of commentary because of Louisa's condition and how she is.
Yeah.
Throughout these books. So with Helen, like, when that whole thing unfolded and that she, again, ends up dying and has been driven mad by the death of her children and things like that. And so to me, it's both feminist and anti-feminist in a way, because it's anti-feminist in the sense, or adhering to the more traditional, because it's showing that, oh, like, she's so, you know, devoted to her children stuff. Yeah. But in a way, it's kind of a feminist cautionary tale. It's because this woman had nothing to live for and nothing going for her except for her children. And so when that was taken away, she just went completely insane.
Well, you know, the feminist element, I think, is there with Louisa and her life and her story arc, really. Helen is a woman of a few decades earlier, isn't she? And so,
of course,
yeah. And so she, I don't see her. I think you're completely right. I don't see her as a feminist figure, really. I think there is a thing where women and their sons, which I wanted to explore, which again is anti-feminist in terms of, you know, would she have been as destroyed if it had been her daughter who'd been killed and so on? If there was an, you know, her sole surviving child was a son, possibly not. So there is a sort of issue that she is more devastated by the fact she's lost all her sons. But, you know, and it's not a feminist thing that she has an affair with her neighbour, because...
Oh, yes, Sir Thomas.
Yeah, because... You know, the sort of when you read some of the accounts of the aristocracy, they were jumping into bed with the near neighbours and so on, especially when their husbands were away at war or whatever. So I don't see her as a feminist figure. I think you're completely right. I think you can write feminist texts without every woman in it being you know, a figure to identify with. But I hope she's realistic, because I think the sort of whole mothers and sons and the sense that she's got no choice, really. The father and daughter have decided to go to India. They're going to sell up, which makes total sense because they've got no heirs to leave the house to, and it's decaying anyway. And they're going to India, which a lot of people did. That was based on, you know, some of the readings, you know, some of the books I read. And so she's just going along with it, and she's just got this sort of final idea, or let's recreate the seance from 1896, without thinking of all the ramifications and how people have changed and how the house has changed and so on. So yes, no, I agree. She's not particularly funny.
She's I don't see her so much as an antagonist. She's a foil to Louisa, because they've both lost children. But Louisa, again, though still haunted by it, she's still able to, you know, move on with her life. And even though, again, she's not in the best position, not in the greatest relationship, it's because she, again, you know, she needed the convention, the security of a husband, but she is pregnant. So, yeah, you brought up an interesting point that I didn't think about, is if Helen's, I sort of thought of it as, you know, she doesn't, it's more like she's gone so crazy because like 4 out of 5 children have died, rather than, but I think you bring up a point, is what if her surviving child had been a son, would that have changed anything?
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think so. I mean, Helen and her daughter, Lilia, are very close. I mean, there is a closeness to them, and they support each other and so on. But I think it's that mother-daughter thing. There's a slight irritation there as well, where she more sort of idolizes her children, her male children. It you know, it's a difficult one to sort of draw out. Yeah.
So going to, like, Helen had her affair with Sir Thomas and stuff, and so, you know, it ends up that Lily had an affair with Sir Thomas's son, and like that whole like sort of substory. I'm thinking, oh no, is this going to be an incestuous brother sister thing? Because that's a thing in Gothic literature.
It is. I drew back from it at the end, really, because there's the potential of it. Well, even
yeah, like I realized it was never pointed either way, and I'm just like, yeah, it was going in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what, this is the whole sort of plotting thing I was talking about earlier. You know, you might, you know, I was trying to, I had to write it down and work out, you know, the sort of, you know, if Helen had an affair with Sir Thomas, but Sir Thomas is, it doesn't stop, actually, Sir Thomas's son and Helen's and Lily marrying. It's just that because of the child and so on, that's, it's all complicated. So, yeah, I was trying to sort of tease it all out when I was finally plotting everything out in terms of how it ends, really.
Yeah. And then I was so mad, like, not mad in like in a bad way, like, not that the writing and the story wasn't like fantastic, but just emotionally very pissed off when the whole deal of, you know, Helen dying in like the little like Gardner, like yeah. Gardner's house and stuff. Cause, and she's done it after, you know, Louisa has agreed, I'm not going to say anything as long as, you know, she's, you know, institutionalized and is, you know, kept away from people and is in a safe environment.
Mm.
And so I always interpreted is that, I forget exactly how it happens, but I always, I interpreted when I read it that basically they let her escape knowing she was going to do something stupid and probably die so that nothing would come out.
I think
they wouldn't have to deal with the embarrassment of, yeah. you know, her institutionalization.
I think that, yeah, I think that that's a good reading of it, really. I left it deliberately vague. They can't prove it, but, you know, there's a way out of where she's, you know, been put, that she finds the work, finds the way. But at the same time, you know, who's to say she would have definitely gone to that, you know, the gardener's house and then, you know, it collapsed on her and so on. So I suppose if they had deliberately let her out, I mean, who's to say what the consequences of that would have been? But I think it's,
yeah.
it's that idea that, she wasn't, you know, she wasn't locked in a room when after she'd confessed. There was a sense that something else could happen. And from a narrative point of view, when I was writing, I wanted that to happen because there would have been a sense then that she's died, Helen, and therefore maybe everything's come to an end. And obviously, as you know, going towards right the end of the book, it's clear it hasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I just got from that interpretation, I just got really, really mad because, again, just the entitlement of, you know, they don't think they deserve to have their name smeared because Helen has committed someone. But even like the sort of merciful or alternative that's presented to Louisa and Louisa accepts it, even if we take that meaning that they wanted her to die anyway, to just not deal with that. So they couldn't even handle the shame of, you know, her going to a mental lunatic asylum. So it just, again, the entitlement of upper class, it just made me so, so mad.
I know. And I think it probably happens now, doesn't it? I mean, probably less so, but it was if you knew the chief constable, you get it in the golden age crime novels. If you knew the village, if you knew the chief constable of the area, you know, you could get various things done to it. Yes, there is, without a doubt, there's an entitlement, but I think nevertheless, Ada does get justice for her death, even if it's, you know, it's not. I don't think she would have more justice if Helen had just been incarcerated in an asylum. I think there's a sense that, you know, her murderer is revealed, and Louisa does push, you know, the investigation right to the very end, really.
So yeah, and you know, Louisa has that little like monologue or soliloquy, you know, with herself, and you know, I agree. I don't think it would have mattered either way, you know, for Ada specifically, personally, or Louisa, just the whole societal concept.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, but all of that aside, my last note is I'm so glad that Louisa got the happy ending with, who was it, George?
George, yes.
Yeah, and again, of all the things we talked about, you know, we did not discuss, you know, her relationship with George, which I think it was very fluid and just really nice. I was waiting for them to reveal that George was the long lost son that didn't die.
Really? No, I didn't even think of that. No.
Like, but it could have been just like, okay, did the child never really die and it's George and he's come to kill someone? And because he seems so nice. And so I'm just like, please don't let George be the bad guy. Please don't rip my heart out like that.
The thing is with George, I mean, I wanted to include a romance element because that's the thing of it's another trope of gothic fiction, isn't there? There's sort of a romance. But, you know, I didn't want to make it the central theme of the book because
right.
It's a modern, you know, it's a modern gothic thriller. So Louisa...
And God forbid that reviewers, you know, give you a bad review because you dare to include more romance and sighing.
I know. So, yes, exactly. So I wanted that Louisa to have a you know, sort of, you know, a possibility of a new life that involves taking photographs and involves, you know, being with a man who's got forward thinking, because that's the thing about George, is that he likes the fact she's a working woman. You know, she goes out to work.
All righty then. So those are all of my notes from the post-spoiler section. You know, we're well into an hour.
Thank you.
Would you like to transition to the Gothometer activity?
Yes, of course. That sounds great.
Okay. So here, let's see. So again, as I mentioned, there are 5 categories and we rate them 1 to 10, 10 being the most. And so category number 1 is atmosphere and setting. So Gothometer, I give the quickening a 10 because it's the ultimate, you know, English like countryside, you know, manor house, again, metaphor for the declining, you know, upper class and you know, all those good things.
That's great. Yeah, yeah. I worked hard on the setting and the atmosphere, so I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Like, if you were compared to, you know, other things you've read, might you yourself judge the quickening atmosphere and setting-wise on a scale of 1 to 10?
I think I would give it about 9 or 10. I mean, I don't give anything ever a 10, so, but I would give it, you know, a high rating in terms of atmosphere and, setting. I'd give it a 9 or 10.
Alrighty then. And then category 2 is the past. And I ranked this at a level 8 because just by the sheer nature of the, you know, back-to-back between the Victorian period and the 1920s and all of that stuff is still relevant and pivotal to the story. So yeah, for all those reasons, I gave it an 8.
Right. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, definitely.
And then we get category number 3, which is the supernatural. And I gave it a 9 because, so this is kind of the category where my old co-host and I would diverge the most.
Okay.
Because she loves like the actual ghost rather than like the sort of, you know, if there's like a logical explanation.
Yeah.
But the way I judge this category is that even if technically at the end, even if there isn't something supernatural, or if it's left ambiguous, or there is a complete logical explanation towards the end, just the use of the tension for the potential of supernatural, mm-hmm. like I will still rank it highly. So for that, I give the quickening a 9 because again, we get that sort of sense of Ada was using the tricks of the trade, but she also has that very pivotal scene of seeing the boy herself. So we don't know.
Oh, that's great. I thank you for that. I mean, my first draft, there was more supernatural in it. So, yeah, I would probably give it an 8 because I think it was originally a 9. And I took some of the supernatural out because I think I'd thrown too much in the first draft. But, yeah, thank you for that. That's great.
Alrighty then. And then category number 4 is heroes, heroines, and villains. And for this, I gave it a 7. Not by any way saying that the characters were not, like, fleshed out or any reason, but it just didn't follow that exact, like, sort of triangle of heroes, like, and heroines, because we've got our main character, Louisa, and we've got, and again, even Helen, you know, she did kill someone, but is she really, like, a villain more as, like, you know?
Yeah.
She is definitely one of those people where you could, you know, use the defense of, like, criminally insane.
Yeah. I mean, there isn't a sort of specific predator, really, is there? Like, you've got getting your classic gothic fiction there. So,
there's, like, you know, it's not even... Helen isn't even, like, quote-unquote... Well, she is... She's not, like, angry in, like, a vengeful sense of how she kills Ada. She's angry, but it's a more desperation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, so for that, all those reasons, I would give it a 7. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I think 7's, I'm happy with that. Yeah, 7, I would agree. Even a 6 or 7, if you're talking about the traditional gothic triangle, as you said, yeah, I think it's got more sort of different sort of characteristics than that.
And then finally, the 5th category is mystery. And I gave this one a 9 because I did not see it happening.
Oh, brilliant.
Again, I was so much trying to prepare myself for George being the bad guy or being the, like, abandoned child that's come to murder his parents.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, a friend who likes my crime fiction read it, my contemporary crime fiction, and they said to me they'd worked it out. And so I'm never entirely sure now if people read it and they don't see it coming because I don't read my reviews. So yeah, no, it's really helpful to know actually that you did. You didn't see it coming. I would say I'd give it an 8 or a 9. Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, because I think if there's as much overlap as there is between crime fiction and gothic, I guess, and sort of gothic thriller, it's less important sometimes if you can figure it out, or if it's a little more obvious. Because if it's purely just crime or mystery novel, the whole point is you're trying to outsmart everyone. Whereas gothic fiction in its, you know, history was a social commentary on a variety of things, and so with the mystery ends up being a little less important, again, depending on how much you know a writer goes on and how literary they want to be about their, you know, how literally they want to be about criticizing class, race, or gender, and all those things.
Exactly. And the thing is, when it's a closed house, I mean, the element of surprise is gone a little bit because it's one of the people in the house, isn't it? I mean, it's so the sort of huge revelation is slightly different than from crime fiction. No, I completely agree. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So I gave it a 9. What would you give it?
I would give it a 9 as well. Thank you.
So I tallied up all your scores, and so you ranked The Quickening 40 out of 50.
Okay, great.
And then for myself, let me just tally them up, and I gave it 43 out of 50.
Thank you for that.
Alrighty then. But yep, still in the 40s, still pretty high. You know, we've noticed the trend, you know, my old co-host and I, of the actual modern gothic novels tend to be more gothic because, you know, there is the history of the template. And so sometimes, you know, contemporary writers follow that tenet a little more, you know, strictly or religiously, whereas, you know, as gothic literature was developing, you know, people didn't have, oh, here's all the things I need to make a gothic novel, and they just went all over.
Yeah, exactly.
Alrighty then, but thank you for that. And as the author, would you like to flip your book at random and read a passage for us?
Okay, so what you want me to just open it up and just read a passage?
Yeah, just totally at random, whatever speaks to you. Pick a card.
Okay. Okay, and how long would it be? Just a minute or so?
Yeah, like just a minute, just like a paragraph or two. Okay. Like, just stop wherever you feel comfortable stopping.
Okay. So, this is page 173, chapter 34. Alice staggered into a chair at George's news, taking me by surprise, given she'd just washed Ada's blood from my body. I was reminded once more that this was a house of grief, and every death must be a reminder of other losses. I felt a cloak of calm descend over me. My mother had once complimented me that I was dependable in a crisis, as if I had had much choice in the matter. Now I would put my self-reliance to good use, and my voice would be heard in relation to Ada's death. I want to talk to the doctor, Janet. Will you go and fetch one of my day outfits? I can hardly meet the man dressed only in an eiderdown. I'll dress in front of the fire. George took a step back. I'll wait for you in Horrocks' room.
Okay, so Ada's just been murdered, and she's telling Alice, the cook, the news?
That's right, yeah. So she's just come back from discovering the body, and obviously Louisa's pregnant, so they've taken her down into the kitchen, and Alice, the cook, can't believe it, who doesn't like Ada. She was a servant in the 1890s, so she remembered Ada from the first time round, is nevertheless absolutely, shocked by everything. And George is sort of, he's being a bit ineffectual at this time. You know, he's hovering around. He's got his journalist instincts are on high alert. There's a body in the garden. But at the same time, he's worried about Louisa. And he's sort of,
yeah.
And it's a woman
who's
sort of got blood on her. So she needs to be washed. And he doesn't know, should he stay? Should he go?
Yeah, that's the whole, that's why I, again, play George off very well. Like trying to balance, like I'm a journalist. I need to know what happens. But also I need to be like sensitive to like everyone around me.
Exactly, yeah. So I, in the end, later on in the passage, Louisa says just go. I mean, she can tell he's chomping at the bit, ready to go and do some sleuthing and some reporting, and she's happy just to be looked after by the women in the house, really, the servant women in the house.
Yeah, and, you know, Louisa's, you know, at least at a, you know, at appearance level, a level of calm, that made me think of Anne Elliot from Persuasion.
Right, oh yes, I love Persuasion, yes.
Yeah, so because Anne, as probably the oldest of Austen's heroines, like, she ends up, you know, being the one to take care of things while everyone's, you know, running around, like, being hysterical. And she's like, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, blah, blah, blah. So that particular passage reminded me of Persuasion and Anne.
Oh, that's nice. And the thing is with Persuasion, Anne Elliot has this sort of sense of life's passed her by. And I think Louisa has that sort of sense as well. Her opportunities have diminished, really. So that's a nice comparison. Thank you.
Yeah, it wasn't in this. I just remember just reading this because it's right before talking to the doctor. I hated that doctor because, again, she's hysterical.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, doctors have, I was reading quite a lot about them and how they disbelieve women, and it's just sit down and you know, sort of, you know, put your feet up. Whereas she actually, like, I've got something to tell you about what I saw, you know, and I think that's again, it's that disbelief from the medical profession, and of course science is another theme of Gothic fiction, isn't it? The sort of emerging science versus the sort of supernatural.
Yes, or how they tie in, like Frankenstein.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, thank you so much for that. That's all I can think of with that specific passage.
That's great. No, thank you. I haven't read that passage before, so it was quite nice to open the book and think, oh, that's, I'll read that bit.
Yeah. So, and that concludes episode 6 of Sublimely Gothic. Thank you so much for joining me, Sarah. It was a true delight.
Thank you for having me. Great questions. I love the fact, you know, you had your non-spoiler and then the spoiler. It was great. And thank you for asking such great questions.
Next time on Sublimely Gothic, stay tuned, where it's going to be the season finale of the Gothic elements in a mainstream franchise. And this time it'll be Game of Thrones. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.